Hello and welcome to Into the Wild, the podcast that brings you animal facts, wildlife updates and nature stories from the professionals to you. It's not uncommon to hear someone say, "Oh, British wildlife is boring." And to be honest, I've probably been guilty of that myself, but it really couldn't be further from the truth. This week, I'm joined by conservationist and science communicator, Lucy Lapwing. Lucy is an expert on British wildlife and we chat everything from the diversity and variety of British nature to the vulnerability of some species and the reasons why it's more important than ever to do your bit for this country's nature. We also touch on HS2, a controversial multi-billion pound construction project in the UK which does have some pros but is having a real cost to England's historical forests and delicate ecosystems. Thanks so much for tuning in and enjoy the show. Lucy, thank you so much for being on the show. How are you?
I'm great, thank you, and thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited.
Oh, thanks very much. Yeah, I've been really looking forward to chatting to you because I've seen you online a lot on Twitter and on Instagram in the last few months, so it's nice to be able to get to chat. Have you been able to enjoy the summer that we've been having, the blissful sunshine?
Yeah, in a weird way. I'm often quite seen as like a negative Nelly about wildlife and conservation, and it's been really heartwarming to see so many people discovering it for the first time.
Yeah.
There seems to be this surge in interest. So, yeah, it's been good. And just discovering nature on my doorstep as well.
Yeah, it has been really nice. Have you found that there's been more around since lockdown? Has that been a thing for where you are?
Not so much more of it, but there's things that I wouldn't have expected to see in places that I have seen it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
There's a river at the end of my street, probably about 300 metres away, and even though it's like nice-ish, you know, it's not unusual to see a trolley chucked in there and McDonald's wrappers and the like, but most nights I go walking down there, I'll see a kingfisher that I never knew was there.
And, oh, wow.
Yeah, stuff like that, so it's been
That's cool, because we've seen a lot more where I am in North London. I mean, I said this on a couple of episodes ago, I don't know if it's new to the area or whether I'm just hear more and looking around and actually spotting it more than I usually do because I've got more time, but yeah, it's we've seen a lot more, like, especially bird species coming around that up Hampstead Heath that I've not seen for a couple of years, so it's been quite nice to see that kind of stuff. But like I said, thanks so much for being on the show. Now, for the listeners, would you mind just telling me who you are and what is it you do?
Yes, so, well, I am a conservationist. I work in conservation in the UK, but basically I'm just an out and proud nature nerd. Love wildlife, love nature, and started as a hobby blogging about my encounters with wildlife from the big to the small, all UK-based about 5 or 6 years ago. And so I'm just a bit of a wildlife communicator online. I just try and show people how mint it is, how weird it is, how it can be, you know, freaky and sexy and bizarre and ugly and beautiful and amazing. And just try and inspire people about it and see how much trouble it's in, and then hopefully take action to try and, you know, reverse this horrible stuff that we're doing to it.
So that's lovely. It came from a real organic place for you, somewhere that you just liked talking about and liked writing about. And was it a big thing for you to, did you enjoy that kind of capturing that moment with someone talking about wildlife? Was that a reason why you started to share it more, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, so I've been kind of a nature nerd for as long as I can remember, and I've always known I wanted to work with wildlife and work in conservation, but I never really knew what I was good at. I'm not very practical, I'm very clumsy and uncoordinated, so don't give me a chainsaw and get me to do practical stuff. You know, I can do a bit of science, but I can't process any data. Maths isn't my strong point. And so I don't really fit into those sciencey, conservation-y boxes that you think of when you think of a conservationist. But I can talk to people about it. I can talk all day about it. And so when I start realising that there's, you know, space in comms for wildlife, it kind of seemed like the perfect fit.
Yeah, and I think that's an excellent point as well. Is like, you know, there's so many different aspects to the nature and wildlife industry that are so important. And communication is one of the most important. You know, the data and all the information is important to have, but to communicate that to people is one of the hardest things sometimes.
Definitely.
So to be good at that, mate, that's a very important part of the industry. So well done for that.
Thank you.
So you said you've always been a nature nerd, which I would somewhat agree with for myself as well. How and when did your love for wildlife begin? Was there a moment for you, or is it something you've always had?
I think it's something I've always had, and I will argue to the death that anybody denies that they do not have it as a kid. Mm. If you show any child, any toddler that's not been tainted by watching an adult's reaction to nature, if you show them wildlife, they will love it. Whether it's a wiggling worm or a snail or a bird or a frog or any of these things, we're naturally drawn to wildlife, and I really truly believe that.
Yeah.
I was just very lucky in that I had parents that didn't really care. Mm. In terms of, I was allowed to free roam, you know, I didn't wear shoes. I was either barefoot or I was in wellies with no socks. There was no in between. And I didn't, you know, brush my hair. I was a really filthy child, but I was allowed to run around, and I was one of the few kids in the rural area where I grew up who was just allowed to play out all the time. And I think, you know, being outside and close to nature, you know, I'd build like little villages in my garden for woodlice and race snails, and I had a bin that I was a champion butterfly catcher, so I'd sneak up on butterflies with my cupped hands and grab them and put them in this weird butterfly bin that I had.
That's amazing.
Didn't kill them. I don't know what the mindset was. I just really liked them. And it just kind of stuck, and it's just something that I've always daydreamed about as a kid. Like, I dream about finding a baby hedgehog and getting to like be its mom. And
oh,
I think most
nice.
Kids have that. I'd argue that most kids do, and along the way we lose it because we're either told that it's scary or dirty or it's going to kill us or whatever.
Yeah.
Or we're given shiny new gadgets that draw us away from it.
Mm. It's, I think the biggest key to seeing that, though, is how quick people get back to it as well. Because it's, you know, I agree again, like, kids love animals. That's why it's on so much clothing. That's why it's always toys. That's why it's always programs, and all the cartoons are always built around animals, because it's one of the first things we learn about. And I think it's, like you said, during lockdown, so many more people have reconnected with that. And that's a big sign that it is in us all. We just have to actually take a few things away, go for a walk, and you start spotting it again, and you realise your love for wildlife has always been there.
100%, yes.
Now, there is one thing I want to chat about, which is, it's a bit random, but you posted a video on Twitter recently, about just under a week ago, that took off. And I saw it, I think, a couple of days after. I don't know how I missed it the first time around, but I saw it a couple of days afterwards. And I need to chat about it. It was a picture, a video, sorry, of you feeding a red-bummed bee? Is that what they're called?
Oh, that's the casual name, a red-tailed bumblebee, yeah. Red-bummed bee.
Sorry. I put that very layman. So,
I prefer it.
Yeah, it's a lot cuter, I think you agree. but the video, I checked this morning, actually, is now, has it pushed over like 3 million views now that you posted? Can you tell us a bit about what you were doing in the video?
Oh, for heaven's sake. I mean, I pride myself kind of on being like a wildlife communicator, and you know, I'll put quite a lot of thought into my posts that I put up, and I'll go searching high and low for like the rarest species of this. And I went out in the garden barefoot in my pyjamas at about midday because this cat, and this is a controversial topic, keeps trying to take my house sparrows off my feeders, and I hate it.
Yeah.
And this cat was back. So I went outside screaming profanities at this ginger cat. And after it cleared off, I turned around and there's just this little bee on the floor now. I've got a red-tailed bumblebee nest under my shed in my garden.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
It's brilliant. I mean, a lot of gardens will have a bumblebee nest thing because they're not like a honeybee hive. They'll only have maybe a couple of hundred individuals, about 100 individuals in your average bumblebee nest. And they don't make honey or anything like that, but there is a queen. And it was a worker and she was just on the floor. So I'm saying she because you know the worker is a female.
Of course.
And she was very lethargic, and I looked at her and just loved her, obviously, so I put my hand down. She crawled onto it, so I tried to pick her up and put her on some of the lavender in the garden, and she was just like, So I put her down, and then I thought, well, I can't just leave you there. So just absentmindedly, I just picked a bit of flower and like, put it in front of her, and she just stuck out her little bee tongue and ran towards it, and I was like,
The most lovely video to, do you know what? It was needed. That's what the internet needed when you tweeted it. It was just a wholesome, quick, didn't mess around.
That's the thing I didn't even think about. I was late for a meeting and needed to like brush my hair and look slightly presentable, so on Zoom. So I just like shoved it on Twitter, and then like an hour later I was like, oh my god, of all the things actually put effort into. This is like the least.
I will say with confidence, that's Twitter for you, okay?
Yeah.
It's
yeah,
literally, totally, yeah. You put all this work into, from me as a comedian side, you write all these jokes, you do all this, you put all this, you know, all the work you put into the into the podcast. You take a funny picture, oh, it goes off. It goes absolutely off. Like, that was just
so
off
fickle.
The cuff. Now, yeah. You and you've said before, I think I've seen another tweet saying you're a big fan of bees. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. But I mean, I'll have a new favourite thing every week, so don't take that as gospel. I do love
Okay. Well, it was this week I saw it, so let's go with that.
Yes.
What do you love about bees? What is it about the bees that you love?
I mean, they're a very easy, they're kind of like a gateway invertebrate, I say. Although butterflies are there as well, but they're an insect that people tend to be able to understand, even if people are fearful of them because of the whole sting thing, which,
yeah,
don't get me started, but they're a fluffy, cute representation of our pollinators, which is such a vital service that insects give us. And I think it's the variety, it's the shock when you tell people just how complex the world of bees is. It's not just, people think bees and you think honey, and that's just one species. We have over 250 in the UK.
What? 250 species in the UK?
Yeah, and that's just in the UK. We've got hardly any compared to, like, other countries. And,
wow.
Just the way they all interact and the way they function. And I mean, I could go off. Do you want to do a podcast just on bees? So you'll have different ones that live in, like, different styles of things. So, for example, there are a couple of species of bee in the UK. If you're getting geeky, I think they're in the Osmia gang. And they specifically build their nests inside empty snail shells. Like, that's how niche they are.
What?
So they need a snail to have died in order for them to be able to make babies, basically.
Oh, this is why I love nature, Lucy. This is why I love nature. That's weird and wonderful.
Crazy! And, you know, like, leafcutter bees will, the females have got a hairy belly, first of all. How sexy is that?
Brilliant.
They carry, like, pollen on. And so these are all solitary bees. So bumblebees are semi-social, so they have their small little colonies. Honeybees are, like, the big social one with the big hives. But all the rest of the bees are generally solitary, so they live on the bill. The females will find a mate, get with him, and then it's just up to her to do the whole kid thing. And she'll either, like, dig a hole in some of it, or she'll find a snail shell, or she'll find a hole. So this is where bee hotels come in, with those holes that you see, either bamboo sticks or holes drilled. And they're just fixated on finding holes in which to build the nests. And, like, leaf cutters will lay, like, a carpet of, like, little discs of leaf that they cut, and then they'll lay a single egg, and then they'll gather all this gooey pollen, and then they'll seal off that cell, and then they'll do it again and again and again, and make, like, 7 or 8 little cells in, like, a little tube. And they're just great. And then they have, like, bee enemies. So there's, like, some bees whose whole purpose is to just, like, sabotage other bees. So there's, like, there's a gang of bees that are called, like, the sharp-tailed bees, and they find, their job is to find leafcutter bees, let them do all their hard work, and then the female has, like, a really, really sharp tail, and it's not a sting. She uses it in, like, a knife, and she'll stab through the leafcutter bees' hard-earned nest and lay her own egg in there, and her egg will hatch first and then eat the leafcutter bee's baby, and that's just how she lives.
What?
Like, it's crazy.
That's insane. Why would you... There's a whole species that's around just by not, I guess, killing off another
bee. Well, it's the same as... So they're all called, like, cuckoo bees, so it's kind of how the cuckoo bird lays its egg in another bird's nest.
God, they're
so
like
most
the...
species of bees have a cuckoo bee.
They're like the ultimate trolls of the bee world. Just absolutely trolling. That's mad.
Yeah, this is why I love them. And, you know, you can go to any sandy bank or meadow or anything and see all this drama going down. It's just great. It's better than curry.
And it continues during lockdown. That's the other best thing about it.
Yes, exactly.
And thrives. You said then about the bug hotels that you see, like, the bee houses to put up. So, like, and a lot of people, as you've seen throughout lockdown, have been putting things like that. How important are they to actually start putting up in our gardens with helping bees? Are they a real big help, or is it just convenient for bees to use?
They are a big help, but there are some actions. So some people argue that the way that we garden can't help wildlife, and I disagree with that, because if large numbers of people do things like bee hotels, then that's great, but other similar, seemingly small-scale actions can make a huge difference. So don't use weed killer.
Yeah.
That's just evil stuff.
Absolutely.
I won't mention any brand names. Don't use pesticides. Again, really easy to just not do. Let go of the urge to tidy, for heaven's sake.
Yeah.
You know, people talk about native wildflowers all the time, but planting a wildflower patch and only having to mow it once a year, you know, you could have a little circle of lawn in that where you could just sit and read your book and then be surrounded by wildflowers. It's just, you know, it's lovely, perfect. Yeah. And yeah, plastic lawns could go and do one. But just, you know, letting go of that urgent need to control and finding, I always say that nature is chaotic and nature hates tidiness, but if you can learn to appreciate the beauty in that chaos, then it becomes stunning and it becomes better than any lawn ever could be. A messy garden is just heaven.
And learn about it as well. I think that's one thing I've done in my garden, is actually put stuff there and then learn what's there or what is attracted to it. And then it becomes a bit of an event being in the garden rather than just sitting in the garden. You're like, oh, I'm going to go and check that log again and see if what's back or what's underneath. And it's actually getting involved in what's in your garden, like you said, and then you find your place within it, being able to sit and relax amongst it. Yeah. And it really does make it a bit more wholesome, I think.
Yes, 100%. And if you learn what stuff is, first of all, it takes away the fear, so it's not just a thing that's buzzing around you. It's like, oh, it's a really cool species of hoverfly. So it takes away that fear. You know if something's likely to, like, sting or bite, which most things won't. And then if you learn to appreciate the value of things like, in massive inverted commas, weeds, then when you see a patch of weeds, you're excited because you're like, oh, am I going to find a beetle? Am I going to find a butterfly? What am I going to find? Instead of looking at it and thinking, ugly, cut it down.
Yeah, that's so true. That's so true. Do you know, one of the first things I did in lockdown for my garden, because it's just a patio square in North London, but it was a bit overrun with a few wild plants and flowers, and we wanted to kind of figure out which was which, so I got a plant ident app and just went round. And the amount of cool plants that I found out we've got, like, we've got different clovers in our garden, we've got lemon balm growing, I don't know why that's there, but that's suddenly, like, just a thing. We've got different, I can't remember the name of them now, there's these beautiful pink flowers that grow up all the time, and it's like, once you learn, like I said, learning about them, you start to appreciate them more.
Yeah, exactly. Preach.
We're going to talk about British wildlife a bit. We covered a bit about bees, but one thing I said to you when I was emailing you is I'm fed up with people saying that British wildlife is boring, compared to the rest of the wildlife around the world, which I completely disagree with, but I thought we would talk about it today to try and correct that. Now, you kind of specialise in British wildlife, so let's change that now, me and you together, Lucy. How diverse is wildlife in Britain? Let's go with that.
It is hugely. And if you think about what are the things that, when you say that wildlife abroad's amazing, what are the things that make that sexy to you? All of those things are applicable to things that we get in the UK. Whether it's predator prey action, you know, something hunting something, you know, if you see like a stoat take down a rabbit, that's just, you know, a stoat's like a third the size of a rabbit.
Yeah.
Crazy. It's like a lion taking down an elephant single-handedly. You know, you don't have to go for the nerdy stuff. Well, where I always go on about invertebrates, which isn't everybody's bag, but there's, you know, like this year I spent, before lockdown, a weekend just watching adders, like a native venomous snake in the UK with these brilliant fiery amber eyes, completely harmless, like they're not going to hurt you if you, you know, as long as you don't like stick your finger in the mouth. Or just, most people don't even know there's snakes in the UK.
Yeah.
You know, we've got three species, lizards, red squirrels, eagles, like massive wingspan, these giant badass looking birds that look like they'll tear your heart out. They're beautiful. There's all sorts of stuff, and you know, the nerdier you get into it, it's not just things abroad that do it for you. It's the little tiny things.
Are there any like wildlife hotspots in Britain to kind of see a variety, or does it kind of change wherever you are in Britain, or is it one area is great for this, one area is great for this, or is there like some hotspots that are just amazing?
There are obviously some hot spots, and again, once you start learning about wildlife, you learn about what you're likely to expect to find wherever you go. So if you learn about habitats and you go to, say, a bog, you know that you might find white-faced darter, which is like a really rare dragonfly, or you might find hobbies, which are a bird of prey that specialise in catching dragonflies, which look like peregrine falcons, and they've got red pantaloons, and they're amazing. Or you might find sundews that are a carnivorous plant that eat flies. Like in the UK, it's like Venus flytrap, but like even better. Or you might go to a coastal area and expect to see terns nesting on the beach, which will come and try and like peck at your head, and you'll see seals and you'll see dolphins and jellyfish. And you know what to expect in the places that you go, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, the UK is sad, and this is where I start being a negative Nelly. We are massively nature depleted, and there is huge potential for us to change the way we manage our land.
Yeah.
To let more wildlife back in.
Yeah, and I think that is that's a really important point, which we're going to come on to again in a minute. But it is something that I think because we've got that mentality of British wildlife is boring. I think sometimes we let it be overtaken by stuff sometimes, because
you know
everyone in Britain cares about African wildlife or something like that because it's big and it's bold, but you've got this unique ecosystem, you know, around the UK as well. It's like, well, this is important, don't let, you know, housing estates just flood it away. Like, you know, it's important as well. And you notice you said something then, sorry, about eagles and birds, and that's something I really has kind of shocked me, I guess, as I've kind of met new people in the nature industry. I had no idea how many birders there were, I mean, around the world, for a start, but in the UK or in Britain as well. Why are so many people in Britain into birds?
Birds are, I mean, how long have you got? They're just brilliant. They're just brilliant. There's something just so... So it's kind of like Pokemon in real life. It's just, it's something that you can process of learning how to identify species. So I'm going to use a word here that sounds like a bad word, but it's not. Jizz, which stands for general impression of size and shape.
You're saying that to a comedian, Lucy, careful, because I will just make a joke.
You get used to talking about jizz and tits and all sorts on your
bed. I'm biting my lip.
I'm just trying to tempt you. So you learn in the process of how to identify birds. So that bird is giving off the jizz of a finch. So it's giving me the vibe that it's a finch or that it's a bird of prey or this or that. And you can identify them by colour. You can identify them by sound. They've got amazing behaviour. They do all these really weird flirty courtship stuff. Some of them are predators, some of them are prey. And seeing that interact with each other.
Yeah.
You get them in your garden, so you can be really up close with them. And it's just their predictability as well. So every year, birds faithfully follow this calendar of these ones arrive now, and then these ones breed, and then these ones arrive, and then these ones leave, and then we get a whole different mix in the winter. And then, and it's just the excitement of knowing what you could see and learning that it's behaviour, and then seeing that play out in the field. And you're like, you know, if you're in a place and you're like, ooh, I feel like I should see... I'm trying to think of an example. Crossbills here, and then you do. It's like, oh my god!
Yeah, like you said, it's that Pokemon Go effect, isn't it? Where you're like, oh my god, I've got it now. I've got it. I've seen it. I know it now.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do we have a large variety of birds in the UK then?
Yes, quite a big one. And this is where it gets technical. But I think, oh god, don't test me. But we've got 300 and something that breed, I think, or have bred. There's like 600 something that are what if you're really birdy, like really nerdy, that you could tick off on your list if you're into that. But that's not, I don't bird like that. I just go to sites and see what I see. In your average garden in like a suburban area, you could get probably easily 40 species in a year.
Wow.
But I mean, if you go to a nature reserve or a place that's richer in nature, in a day, you could see well over 100 in a single day, like species of birds.
That's mad, isn't it? When you think about it, kind of like when we were talking about the bee species a minute ago of being 250 in the UK, and then thinking that you could go, I mean, if I pick a park closest to me, like Hampstead Heath or something, and you go for a walk up there, you could pick a, you know, you see jays, you see woodpeckers, you see kestrels, you see kites, you just see, and like you said, magpies, blackbirds, crows, everything.
Yes.
Just all around. It's amazing, really, when you start to actually look about how many species there are. You also mentioned marine life as well, and that's something that I think a lot of people easily forget about, because we always think of our waters as being rough and kind of a bit, you know, wavy and a bit murky. But it's surprising. In fact, one of my friends posted a picture, who's another comedian, just of a bullhuss that had washed up. It was dead on the beach, and she saw it in Wales, and she was like, oh, what's this? And I was like, that's a shark, mate. And she was like, what?
Wow.
And she had no idea that that's what we had sharks like that. I was like, yeah, that is a species of shark. And like that's living in our coastline. So it's like, I think people forget that we have that around our coast as well.
Yes, definitely. I mean, like orcas off Scotland.
Yeah.
You know, like Free Willy off of Scotland. Like people just don't know this. And basking sharks. Is that the second biggest fish in the world? And
that's one thing I can't believe. I can't believe that people don't know that, that's not celebrated enough, I don't think, that we have basking sharks in our waters.
Yeah, and dolphins and seals and there was a swordfish last week, like off of Scotland somewhere. And, but then again, this is nothing compared to what it could be.
Yeah.
Like, we just accept that we've got no nature instead of questioning why. That, you know, it's not that there's a place in the world that nature just doesn't like. It's got to have been something we've done.
Yeah.
You know, and the sea should be full. Like, all around the UK, you should be able to see whales and orca and all of this. So,
yeah,
like I said, there's potential.
There really is. And it's, I can't remember who, someone tweeted a video of a group of basking sharks. I think it was off the coast in Wales throughout lockdown. Did you see it? For me, I watched that probably about 20-odd times. And I was like, that for me is a dream. Like, why would you not want that? Imagine if you were just going for a walk and that's what you were seeing off the coast. Because like you said, the second largest fish and just the intensity of seeing that is incredible. And just knowing, and then you look deeper in the water and you've got ray species down there, you've got jellyfish, you've got, you know, anemones, you've got all these things that we associate with tropical seas, but are all in our native temperate seas as well. And I think, it's an area that's often missed for the UK.
Definitely.
We're going to talk about some vulnerable species at the moment, which we won't get too heavy, but they're important. But they are important to talk about. So what is, as if we kind of just pick a few kind of vulnerable species that we get in the UK?
Not to go in really like deep straight in, but we're probably going to lose turtle doves in the next decade at the most.
Oh, really?
As a breeding species of bird.
Wow.
They've declined by over 98%. And these are birds that were so common, it was like they were barely worth a mention, I don't know, 60, 70 years ago?
Jesus.
It was almost like pigeons now. You're just like, yeah, pigeon. It was like, yeah, turtle. And now they're like almost gone.
By 98%?
And cuckoos, they've declined massively.
Yeah.
I think about 70%. I'll try not to stick it to two birdies. So like hedgehogs. Hedgehogs have declined from an approximate population of 30-something million in, like, the 70s, I think, to about a million now. So that's a massive decline.
What? That meant 20... Jesus Christ, that's bad.
Sorry, straight into the depressing.
No, but that's... these numbers are kind of important to know as well, because you kind of... Again, it's what you said a minute ago with going, don't just accept it's a thing, start question why that's happening. That is a huge number to lose for an animal like a hedgehog.
Yeah.
Wow.
Everybody loves a hedgehog.
Who doesn't?
Exactly.
I found out the babies are called hoglets the other day. I nearly cried.
Exactly. But so many people don't, and it's not a blame thing at all, because if you don't know, then you don't know you're doing something wrong. But so many people will, without thought, put out things like rat poison because it's in a rat. Or they'll put out things like slug pellets.
Yeah.
So, hedgehog eats that, that's going to be messed up. If a mouse or a rat takes some rat poison and then crawls off and dies somewhere, and an owl gets it, there's some really depressing figures I read recently about I can't remember the exact percent, but it was like a terrifying percent of kestrels that have rodenticide in their system, so effectively rat poison, because they eat small mammals. This beautiful little delicate bird of prey.
Yeah.
Because people just hate the rodents and they want rid of them, instead of letting nature be the rodent killer.
Yeah, and this is what we forget. Like, again, it's an important thing to remember, is that nature works as a circle. So we all know about the food cycle and food chains and stuff like that. And we've got to, we have to know that if we add something into that, whether it be a poison, a pellet, a treatment, that's just going to work its way into the system as well and have an effect on many species, not just the one you're targeting.
Yeah, it's about accepting that nature is going to affect us and learning how to live with that. There seems to be this kind of human arrogance across the world that we shouldn't be affected by nature. And like, if I've got wormholes in my radishes, because I just buy like organic veg because I don't want to be putting pesticides in, if I've got, you know, my lettuce has got nibble holes in from slugs, it tastes fine and I'm not getting ill from it. Like, it's not going to kill me that a slug's nibbled my lettuce. Sounds like an innuendo.
We're a precious species, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly. So,
for everyone listening now, like, if they wanted to help in nature for these kind of things that we're talking about, and I think you touched on a few of them there, but what else can people actively do to help?
I think learning about nature, taking the time to learn about it is one big thing, because then you can be enraged when the things are happening.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't know what a skylark is and what it sounds like, then you're not going to miss it when its song disappears out of the meadows above your heads, like, because you don't know what it is.
Yeah.
I'd say become as moany as the people who hate the wildlife. Because one thing that's, like, I've written so many emails this year to local authority near me, like, about cutting of wildflower banks and verges and things.
Yep.
The number of complaints they get from the tidy brigade, we need to be the people saying, no, I want it to be untidy because I want it to be messy for nature. I want those wildflowers. I want, you know. So speak up. just think about what you're purchasing, thinking about your consumption. You know, we're all human. We all have to consume things and buy things and eat food. But think about how you can do that with the least impact. So I only buy secondhand clothes. I only buy organic food where I can. I try and shop as plastic free as I can. It's just little actions like that that it at least sends the message. Even if it doesn't change the world, it sends the message that things need to change.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's one thing else, that there's one more thing I wanted to bring up on this kind of, you know, when we're talking about affecting British wildlife. And I want to quickly talk about HS2, which is has been going on for it seems like forever now. But can, for the listeners that might not know what that is, can you in some way just shed a bit of light on what HS2 is for us?
So HS2...
Sorry to do this to you, Lucy.
No, it's fine. It's a very complicated, very political project to build a high-speed rail link from London to the north of England via the Midlands, which on the surface it could be argued as a good thing because it is connecting, what is it, some famous MP called it, the unloved north, to London, and it's an alternative. It's, you know, it's a public transport link that's technically supposed to be less carbon emissions, blah, blah, blah. What it has turned into is a massively terrifyingly expensive project, hundreds of billions of pounds. It's ploughing through, I think, over 100 little patches of ancient woodland habitat. You can't mitigate against destroying ancient woodland. I can't bang this drum enough. You cannot. Planting some trees, some little saplings with little bits of plastic around them is not going to replace a 400-year-old oak tree that hosts over 300 species of invertebrates. It's never going to do that. It's, you know, people try and talk it down. So people who support the project say that it's not a problem. You know, all these things are going to be mitigated against. But the fact that you've got your biggest environmental charities, NGOs in the UK speaking up against it, the Wildlife Trust, the RSPB, the Woodland Trust, these are massively supported public bodies that have millions of members between them, millions of individuals, and they are backed up by science, and they are saying it is damaging to our wildlife and our nature. And I choose to believe them over people that have got financial interests in building the railway.
I think that's fair.
So, it's again, it, like, nature's always like in the back of the mind when you have these big infrastructure projects, because people, again, it's people don't know wildlife, so why should they give a monkeys about it? They don't know what it is.
And again, like, this is, like you said, it's a hugely political and become quite a complicated in some areas thing that's happening, and I know it's being battled against constantly by people in the wildlife and nature industry. But people listening at home, is there anything they can do that could, is their bit, whether it be a petition or something else, or a donation to charities who are actively fighting for this? Is there anything people can do?
Yeah. So there's some really good organisations that you can support. So whether it's supporting an organisation long-term through membership, I feel like I'm a member of all of them by now, but, you know, your main wildlife gang, just, you know, whatever species you want to defend.
Yeah.
If you've got a particular passion for dragonflies, there's British Dragonfly Society, butterflies, there's Butterfly Conservation. But really big ones like the Wildlife Trust, the RSPB, the Woodland Trust, that will fight that fight and put the money into the research. Becoming a member is a really good thing to do if you can afford it. Otherwise, going to them and just seeing what they're asking you to do. So seeing if there is a petition to sign. Can you email your MP about it? Chris Packham and co are really good at kind of pointing into the direction of little actions you can take to see what they're saying about it. There is a campaign called Stop HS2 that are always looking for volunteers as well, so you can talk to them.
Amazing. And my last question to you on the show is something I ask everyone at the end, is if you could pass on one bit of advice onto everyone regarding the natural world, what would you pass on?
Don't be afraid of it.
Mm.
Get over the fear. Everybody's got a little bit of fear. Even I have. I hate horseflies. get over the fear of nature, because we are it. It is us. And if you take the time to learn about it, then you can see just how much it matters, because it's like, it's bloody everything. It is everything. Yeah. And we need it.
Yeah, absolutely. Lucy, thank you so much for being on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, and I really appreciate
your
time.
Thank you so much.
And
thank you for having me.
No problem at all. I'll keep in touch and I'll speak soon.
Yes, thank you, Ryan.
Thanks again for listening. If you'd like to keep up to date with the projects and shows that Lucy is working on, you can do so on Twitter and Instagram at Lucy_Lapwing. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify and Podbean. You can also get in touch on social media at Into the Wild Pod. Whether it's just to say hello, share some thoughts on an episode, or even let me know what you want to hear about next. Until next time, keep well, stay safe, mask up, and live the good life.